Should we bow in? Three bows, maybe? I want to thank you all very much for having me. I haven't given a Dharma talk in some time now, and we'll see how I do. But I was going to allow this to be informal in a lot of ways. So if you have a question at any point, just put your hands in gassho, and if I'll keep my eyes open, and if I have somebody has a question, we'll stop, go to the question, and go on. So many times I have had questions during a talk or a discussion with people, and by the time I get a chance to ask a question, I've forgotten what my question was. So let's not do that. Let's just put your hands in gassho, and if we have a question, I'll try to answer it as soon as possible. This is going to be a combination explanation of lay entrustment and what lay entrustment means to me, and some of the issues and perks of being lay entrusted, and a way-seeking mind talk to explain how I got here. So if you'll indulge me, I'll tell a little bit of my backstory first, and then get into the issues about lay entrustment. I was born during World War II in a military base. My parents were from West Texas. Shortly after my birth, my father was invited to South America to build cotton gins for a multinational agricultural company that was based in Houston, Texas. And we lived in São Paulo, Brazil from the middle, late 40s until the middle, late 50s. And I grew up in while I had American parents and spoke English at home, I spoke mostly Portuguese with my peers and half Portuguese, half English at school. We moved back to the States. Why that's relevant is I went to this wonderful, wonderful private school in São Paulo that had us reading the things like Ulysses in the third grade. We were way ahead of what I found later to be public school, excuse me, in Texas in the later 50s. And that led me on a path of questioning everything from a very young age. I came to California in 1966 with a rock and roll band and soon became friends with members of the Jefferson Airplane, and soon found out that I was a much better talker than I was a musician. So I was hired first as their house staff producer and later as their road manager, and then became the road manager of Hot Tuna, and finally worked as the road manager of Natalie Cole. So I got to go all over the world with rock and roll bands and got paid for it for about 10 years. What's not to like? Out of that, excuse me one second. I'm going to have a swig of water here. Out of the wonderful education and all of that touring, I became quite in love with, I apologize for my throat. I became very interested in Zen Buddhism. I read a number of autobiographies of people who had gone to Japan and sat with Rinzai masters. And in 1979, I went and did a sesshin with Joshu Sasaki Roshi on the top of Mount Baldy at Mount Baldy Zen Center, a Rinzai teacher who was very strict. And I fell in love with the practice, and I ended up sitting there many times over the next, I probably did four sesshins a year for about 10 years. But I didn't practice at all in between, which was quite, I didn't sit at all. I went and did sesshin, and that was all that I ever did. In 1983, my youngest daughter, my oldest daughter, got leukemia. And when she got leukemia, I needed to have a daily practice. By that time, I discovered San Francisco Zen Center was only 10 minutes away from my house. And I went and met Michael Wanger, and he became my Soto Zen teacher. And I began practicing. I began practicing with Michael and practiced with him for the, still practice with Michael now some 40 years later. But I didn't take Jukai. How many of y'all have taken Jukai? So about half? I had some resistance to becoming part of a group, actually. I think that was my biggest resistance. And so it took me 15 years to sew my rakusu. But when I finally took Jukai in 2000, it was an incredible emotional experience. I remember crying during the ceremony. It was very, very emotional for me. And during those years from, say, 1990 to 2010, I practiced like a priest would, like a resident would at San Francisco Zen Center. I was at Zazen every morning at 5. I often would come back in the afternoon because I had a Doan Road job in the afternoon, and I would sit in the afternoon, so I would be sitting twice a day there. This was during a period when I had 4 children, mostly in private school, a mortgage, a wife of now 50 years, cars, dogs, the entire catastrophe. And yet I managed to practice as if I was a resident. Of course, I had a job and all the things that come with working in the job. I asked Michael in 2002, 2003, if I would ever be Shuso. Shuso is the head monk of a practice period, the head student of a practice period. And it was that office was the stepping stone to becoming a teacher. And I was interested at that point in becoming a teacher at some point in my life. And I was wondering if I would ever be Shuso, because I had seen all the Shusos to that time had almost all done practice periods at Tassajara, had done residential practice periods away from San Francisco or away from where I was living and where I lived with my family. And I could never leave my family and my job to go to do 3 or 4 months at Tassajara or the 3 or 4 months of in-house practice period. So I thought that would never happen. But I asked Michael, nevertheless, if I would ever be Shuso. And Michael said, if you go and do a practice period at Tassajara, you'll be Shuso the next proximate practice period. And so I was feeling quite defeated over that. I put it out of my mind and continued to practice as a total layman and with no thoughts of ever teaching. To my surprise, 2 years later, I was invited to be Shuso. And it was the happiest part of my life, other than my honeymoon and the right after the births of my children. I just loved being Shuso. For 3 months, I met with the students and gave Dharma talks and cleaned the bathrooms and went through all of the things that one does as a Shuso. And I was quite fulfilled and thought that was probably the end to what I would be doing. And so I was quite surprised a few years later when Mel Weitzman and Michael Wanger came to me and asked me if I would like to be lay entrusted. And so I accepted and was lay entrusted in 2011 and began teaching. I went back to Brazil and taught with a very interesting Zen teacher in Brazil, in São Paulo, and as well as teaching at San Francisco Zen Center, led some classes at Tassajara, led some classes at Green Gulch, taught and gave Dharma talks all over the United States, Houston, Austin, Albuquerque, Chapel Hill, et cetera. About 3 years ago, I retired formally from teaching and had decided that I would not teach anymore, except for the students that I already had. I wouldn't give formal Dharma talks or go out and seek new students or anything. I decided that my body was beginning to break down. I'm almost 78, so let's face it, I'm not a spring chicken. And I retired from teaching, and then this spring, or last fall, there was a very sad incident that occurred in my family, and I decided to start teaching again. I lost my son to suicide last September. And that was a catalyst for me to really double down on my teaching as well as practicing. I started sitting a lot. I remember saying to myself, as a result of Matthew's suicide, I said to myself, what would I advise a student to do that was going through this suffering? And I said that I would advise to sit and just sit with it and see what happens. So I began sitting 2, 3, 4 hours a day, doing lots of one-day sittings on Zoom, interacting with students and people as much as I can. And that's been my path. Lay entrustment was originally designed by Mel Weitzman, Sojourn Mel Weitzman, one of the founding teachers of San Francisco Zen Center after Suzuki Roshi died, as a teaching position and as an honorable position for those students who were chose to remain lay and wanted to teach or wanted to serve the Sangha in a much wider capacity than they have been, than they were doing, and to have an office and a directive to go ahead and do that. There is no lay entrustment in Japan, but Mel thought that there was something missing, especially with our tradition of we're not exactly monks and we're not exactly laymen. So Mel started giving lay entrustment. He was Michael Wanger's teacher, Enru and my teacher, and Mel and Michael met with me in 2011 and asked if I would want to take lay entrustment. And that was the meeting, that was the bridge to beginning to get lay entrustment. I see there's people that have been lay entrusted use it in all kinds of different ways. I, in the process of talking to people preparing for this Dharma talk, I talked to people that are teaching and only teaching. I talked to people that, one woman who is writing books, she is now writing all of the Jakarta tales into children's books for second and third graders. And she's gonna be published on Chambala very soon with those books. So there's authors, there's teachers, there's people who want to serve the Sangha in administrative ways as well. I don't know what else I can say except that it was very moving to me to become lay entrusted. I really would like to answer your questions. I feel that this would be better if it was interactive than if I'm just to sit here and pontificate. So does anybody have any questions about land trustment or about the issues? Yes.
Hello, are you?
Naomi.
Interview on Jamie. My question is about the future.
Oh, yeah.
So you are land trusted, but what about then becoming transmitted? What about the future? You're doing you're seeding, you're teaching. It's and I love Rebecca Starmatov. I was so sad when you announced that you retired, and then I was happy to take all your classes. And so I'm asking, yeah, what about the future?
Well, my future or the future of land trustment or both?
Both. Your future first.
Well, you know, I had a long talk with Tia Strozer about land trustment in the future in preparation for this Dharma talk. And Tia is now beginning to give lay transmission.
Hmm.
Prior to Tia's giving lay transmission, the only person that had received lay transmission was the abiding teacher, Leslie James, at Tassajara.
Hmm.
This lay transmission is a response to many of our lay teachers that feel that their position as lay teachers leaves them with no ability to transmit the teaching to others.
Yeah.
Lay entrusted people cannot give jukai, and they cannot give transmission to anybody. I don't see it as a problem generally, but most teachers do. If I have a student who wants to take Jukai, I have to send them to a transmitted priest like Enru for the ceremony. I don't think that's a problem because it fosters community. If I send them to Enru, or if I send them to Michael, or if I send them to Rosalie Curtis, or to Mark Lancaster, it just fosters a sense that they have even more teachers to go to with their questions, with their problems, with their Dharma thoughts. I see it as not a problem. What I do see as a problem is that as a teacher in the Zen, Soto Zen lineage, and by the way, Soto Zen does not recognize lay entrusted teachers at all, but as a teacher in the Soto Zen lineage, there's a unspoken directive to pass your understanding on to somebody else. You're always supposed to have a successor. And if you're not able to formally anoint that successor with transmission, it is somewhat difficult. How are you going to handle having someone who's a successor be given to some other teacher to give them the formal recognition of transmission in order to get them lay entrusted, say? If I was to give Rob Walker, who you know, Ilaria, if I was to say I wanted to give him lay entrustment, who would do it for me? Wouldn't they want to study? Wouldn't they want to meet with Rob many, many times before they would do it? It's a very difficult question and a question that hasn't been answered. I thought about pushing for my own transmission recently so that I could have the ability to give transmission to my students, both Jukai and the future lay entrustment if I wanted to do that. But after thinking about it for a few days, I decided that it was just a little bit too narcissistic to, for me to pursue that. So I'm not gonna pursue that. I'm gonna continue to rely on the goodwill of other priests, of priests to help me do my transmission when it comes up. So far, Rosalie, Mark Lancaster, Michael Wanger have not refused anybody that I wanted to get done. So it's a moot point right now. Maybe it won't be in the future. Does that answer your question, Laura? Naomi, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. I was wondering if you could speak to the sort of dynamic tension maybe, or the differences that you see between being a lay entrusted teacher with a focus on being a lay person versus being an ordained priest.
Well, sometimes there's a lot of that stuff and sometimes there's not very much. Different priests have a different levels of acceptance with the lay entrusted teacher. I think it's a shame that we're not allowed to join the Soto Zen Teachers Association. We have our own association, the Lay Zen Teachers Association, but we can't join the Priests Association. I think that in itself creates a dual citizenry type of situation. But in practical effect, the best person usually surfaces with a job. The most recent Tonto of San Francisco Zen Center was the Tonto Nancy Petrin with a blue rakusu, not even lay entrusted, but just a Jukai taken person holding one of the highest offices that you can hold inside of the Zendo. And she did a beautiful job. She received lay entrustment after the end of her service, but not before. But the tensions are there and it's so different with each person. There are priests that totally embrace my role and there's other people that hold me at arm's length. And it's kind of sad, but the movement is towards endorsing lay teachers. And I think it'll all start changing in that direction over the next few years. Thank you for your question. Yes, ma'am. Betty.
Hi. I'm trying to understand the difference between the lay entrustment and what you would go through to become a priest. You were saying that you were thinking that maybe you would go forward with that is what I was understanding. And so I was trying to understand how that would come about.
Well, my question, what I was referring to was I got all interested in lay transmission from my conversations with Tia Strozer because it would have given me the opportunity to have passed on Jukai and lay entrustment and to my own students instead of having to hand them off to a priest for the ceremony.
Right.
But I never considered being a priest. It was, that seemed so far from my practice that it didn't compute for me. As I said a little bit, I have a job, or I had a job until I retired recently. I had raised four children. I was always living the life of a layman in the marketplace, and becoming a priest seemed to me that it would be a rejection of where I was actually doing my practice, which was in the marketplace.
That's what I was trying to understand in our country, you know, how one defines a priest, you know, in America, in Soto Zen. because my only experience really closely is with Norman Fisher and John Evans, both of whom are priests, from my understanding. I might be wrong, but
they're both priests.
Both priests. And yet they're very active kind of in the lay world. I mean, they teach a lot. But so I'm trying to see, where's that dividing line?
It moves every time you try to grab it. You know, there's, I'll tell you, it moves personally, it moves philosophically, it just moves. I remember asking Michael what I should do, Michael Wenger, my own teacher, what I should do if there's no priest at a service. Should I conduct the service? And he said, oh yes, you should step in and be the doshi, which is the presiding priest. You should be the doshi if there's no doshi. And then Michael was out of town when he first moved to Dragon's Leap. Alara, you may remember this, but he was out of town when he first moved over to Dragon's Leap, and he gave me the keys to his house, and he asked me to open up the Zendo for people in the morning. And I said, oh, good, I can do the Jundo, which is the walk around all everybody's seats while they put their hands up in Gassho, that the priest who's officiating does in the morning. And Michael didn't want me to do the Jundo. He wanted me to act as Doshi, but he didn't want me to do the Jundo. And I never could figure it out. And this is from somebody who I'm very close to. I can't figure it out. So if I couldn't figure it out, I don't expect you to, and I can't, certainly wouldn't be the one that can explain it. But we are moving towards a more lay practice and towards more lay officiants. I think we will always have priests, and some people feel called to be priests. I know Alaria's main squeeze, is it going to call him that, Alaria? Kyle is a priest now. And I was always surprised that Kyle wanted to be a priest because he was such a strong lay practitioner. So I don't know.
The so answer is, I don't know. Who decides that someone becomes a priest?
I think that you have to decide that you're going to become a priest, and then you ask your teacher if you're ready and to begin your training.
Hmm. So there is set training.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Much more formal training and much more formal ceremonies to become a priest than there is to become a layperson.
Okay.
My lay entrusted ceremony lasted 6 hours, including the part that 5 hours of which was behind closed doors. Is Enru here? Is she? You're here? How long did it take? How long was your ceremony, Enru, when you became a priest?
It was 8 days.
8 days.
And yeah. depending on where you're doing it and how intensely you're doing it, it can be 28 days. Right. It kind of depends on where you're located, where your teacher is. It was a tough 8 days.
And a lot of those 8 days, you're up 24 hours.
Yeah. There's a lot to do.
Yeah. Please, more questions. Randy, do you have a question?
I have a statement and a question.
Okay.
I appreciate you sharing significant aspects of your life with us. And gives us more understanding. The other thing was, it sounds like you've kind of moved in and out of your relationship with Zen. And it sounds like, particularly when there was a tragedy in your life, it kind of made you come back to Zen. And I'd just like for you to elaborate on that a bit and elaborate the effect that having coming back to Zen when you had those tragedies, what impact did that have?
That's a great question. And thank you for your question, Randy. You know, I have a great history of embracing something so firmly that my muscle memory gets tired and I almost burn out with it. So this has been a pattern of mine throughout my engagement with everything, but especially with Zen. At least I've been practicing Zen for 43 years. In that 43 years, I've taken 6 months sabbaticals or so away from Zen at least a half a dozen times and not practiced at all. And then come back to it. And every time I've come back to it, I feel like my practice has matured. You know, as a musician, I would move away from practicing for a while, not play for a while. And then after a while, I would just listen to the birds and listen to the songs on the radio. And it seemed like my understanding of sound became better. And when I came back to music, I was always playing better than I did if I had spent that whole time practicing. So it's a kind of a similar thing. It's almost analogous that moving away from Zen for me and not practicing for 6 months or more, when I come back to it, my practice is deeper and more profound. And usually I'm moved to move away from Zen because of burnout. And then I'm moved to go back to Zen because of some incident, not always tragedy, but often a difficulty, but sometimes a celebration as well. And whenever I do go back, I think my practice is better. Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Jamie.
Beth.
Since you're in the swirl of everyday life, and sometimes that swirl is very hard to calm yourself down and actually sit. And how did you have any secret to help you do that through all these years of being a lay practitioner?
I've been able to practice in any place, in any situation. I worked in the corporate world for a number of years. And one time my boss came by and listened to me on the phone, and I was haranguing one of my customers. And after I got off the phone, my boss said, "You didn't sit today, did you?" And I said, "No." And he bought me a cushion and set it up in the conference room. And he wanted me to sit at least 20 minutes twice a day on the job. So I was able to sit there. I coached soccer and played soccer for many years. I used to take a cushion out to the soccer field and put it down at the corner of where the corner flag is. And in between games or at halftime, I would go and sit while everybody else was muttering and stuff. So I haven't had many problems in being able to sit in the midst of madness. I consider airports. That was one of my great discoveries. If I could sit in an airport waiting room, I can sit anywhere. So I don't have that problem, Beth. I've always loved sitting. Anyone else? Oh, yes, Betty.
I was wondering if Christopher, I saw you do that. Christopher, did you have a question?
Oh, sorry, Christopher.
I'm sorry. I think I was just bowing automatically, but I do. I will ask, I think, have you had any opportunities to interact with priests from Japan in the U.S.? One of my considerations or concerns with lay entrustment is that there's a non-zero chance that I will practice in Japan for some period later in my life. And I'm just curious if you've had any experience with them and how they received you and that sort of thing.
Thank you for your question. You know, I have very limited experience with Japanese priests in the United States. I met Koben Chino a number of times, and I've met Katagiri Roshi once or twice, and I've done sesshins with Okamura Roshi. But none of them have been on an intimate way. That said, I have become friends with young Japanese priests when I was working in South America with the Brazilian Sangha. Mm-hmm. It may come as a surprise to most Americans, but there was a very large Japanese immigration into Brazil in the early 1900s. And so there's probably more Soto Zen temples in and around South Brazil than there is in the entirety of the United States. There's 500,000 people of Japanese descent in the city of São Paulo alone. So they have Japanese Soto missions all over Brazil, and much similarly to what we had in the United States when Suzuki Roshi came, young Brazilians have been going to these Soto Zen temples and sitting Zazen, whereas the Japanese descendants of the immigrants have only interest in the cultural aspects of what is going on in these temples. And so the young Japanese priests in Brazil have become very, very interested in the young Brazilians. And they started sitting sesshins with the young Brazilians and leading some of those sesshins and sometimes being led by the young Brazilians. So in that dynamic, in that world, I met a number of younger 20s, early 30s Japanese priests. And I don't think they knew what lay entrustment was because it's not a big thing in South America yet. But they were very, very supportive of anybody who was leading or co-leading a sesshin there. And it was very gratifying for it to happen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Y'all are done with me?
I actually did a second question if nobody else is going to. You mentioned, briefly talked about some of the training to become a priest. Was there any, aside from your practice, was there any dedicated training or route after discussing lay entrustment and before you were lay entrusted?
Thank you for your question. The short answer was no. Sewing was enough of a challenge to me. I have every excuse and every piece of resistance that one can have to sewing, and it's a dang shame. But that's the truth of the matter. But I think your teacher is always preparing you for that. You know, Michael really would push his students, no matter where they were, he would push them further. And that was the brilliance of Michael Wanger. And yeah, that's enough.
So Jamie, I have a question related to robes. I've done a practice period with Lessa James, and she has a green okesa. Right? Not just a green rakusa, but a green okesa. So is that, from a visibility standpoint, the kind of the difference between somebody who's been Dharma entrusted and somebody who's been Dharma transmitted?
Thanks for your question. That's a good question. Prior to Tia's giving Pamela Weiss lay transmission, Leslie was the only person who had it. And so it was almost a unique recognition and endorsement of her teaching for her to have lay transmission and be the abiding teacher at Tassajara. And to my understanding, an abiding teacher, a transmitted teacher, can give Jukai and can also give lay entrustment to somebody else. So she was unique in doing that. And the rest of us didn't have that portfolio. Tia Strozer is trying to upset the apple cart. She's really big on seeing the future of American Zen inside of lay entrustment and lay teachers. And so she's beginning to give all of her senior teachers lay transmission with the endorsement of being able to give Jukai and lay entrustment to their students. We'll see what happens next. Stay tuned.
Right, but they would not be able to, for example, ordain a priest.
That's right. The short answer is that's right. And I also don't, I think they're being Martin Luther and seeing no need to ordain a priest. So it's transmission outside of the priesthood. I'm hoping that we can come together with some kind of criteria that everybody can feel like is working for them within the Soto Zen Teachers Association and the Lay Zen Teachers Association. I'd like to see a dialogue between those two associations to come up with something where there's not, it's my way or the highway by either one of them. You.
Jamie, thank you so much for sharing all of these experiences. I'm reminded of a monk, and I'm forgetting the name now, who went on a very lengthy journey, and then he, at the age of 80, he started teaching, and he taught, you might remember the name of this monk. It's a story
in it's Buddhism. Joshu.
Joshu. Doshu, yeah. And he started teaching at the age of 80, and I think he taught till he was 100, correct?
120.
Okay, so there's 40 years, right? So to everyone watching today, I just want to say there's lots of years ahead.
Yeah, and it also said if an old teacher is full of BS, I won't listen to him. And if a young child gives me the Dharma, that's my teacher.
Right. Yeah. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I wonder if some folks maybe who haven't asked a question or spoken would like to say hello. Or Laria, did you have another question? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll be quick so that I'll allow the other people to talk. I was wondering whether you could share with us later some of the book that you said you read times ago about the biographies of, you know, Zen teachers or monks that were practicing in Japan. I would really love that. I've been reading some of, you know, Geshin's book, Jiryu's book, and then and I love to read about those experiences. And so, yeah, if you could share with us later, it would be great.
Well, let me say right off the top of my head,
yeah,
The Empty Mirror by Jan William van der Wettering, I've read about 6 times. And it's not only full of his diary, but it's also full of advice that he got from his Zen teachers that still make sense to me today. At one point, he asked a Zen teacher, what have you learned from Zen? And the Zen teacher says, concentrate, do your best, and be, how do you put it? And don't get entangled with the results. Whatever the result is, accept it.
So I wonder if you don't, if I call your name and you don't want to say anything, just put your hands in Gusha and we'll know that that's fine. But if you would like to unmute your mic and say hello or ask a question, let's go to Paula.
Thank you so much. And I do want to express that I'm very grateful for being able to hear you speak, Jamie. I can't quite formulate any questions because this and the conversation that everybody is having is just kind of swirling around inside. Another ingredient. But I'm very, very thankful, very privileged feeling to be able to listen to this and kind of feel out the different layers. So thank you.
You're welcome. You know, if anybody has a comment or a question that they would like to email me later, I'm happy to respond to any emails that y'all have. Enru can give y'all my email address.
Yes.
And Enru, I have it's a little bit out of date. It's dated 2005, but I have a master's thesis on lay entrustment that was prepared by a student of Mel's at the time. And it's about 110 pages long, and it gives a lot of the history, and I can forward that to anybody or to you that wants it.
That'd be great. Thank you. Suzanne, would you like to say hello?
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for your talk. I had a very narrow question. It's actually a question for Enryu, if you don't mind answering this. Enryu is about to ordain a priest in our Sangha. I think this is your first priest. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is Sato's ordination going to take 8 days?
No. He's not getting transmission. He's being ordained as a novice priest.
And that's my question. There seem to be many different steps. There's sort of this novice step, and then there's another step, and then there's transmission. Could you explain that in 5 seconds?
Well, Jamie mentioned the role of being head student as being very important in someone's development. And so what's happening within San Francisco Zen Center is that, and this has happened for decades, is that the head student is not always a priest.
Right.
The head student is often a lay person. Most often someone who's received Jukai, right, who's taken lay precepts. But you know, it could be that somebody is ordained as a priest and then they become Shuso for a period, and then they go into some deep residential training before they become transmitted. That would typically be what's happening right now in our lineage. But as Jamie's explaining, you know, there are people who have practiced like he for 4 or 5 decades who can expound the Dharma, but, you know, can't go live at Tassajara for 3 or 6 months. So, you know, this other way of recognizing them, giving them office to teach fully, has been the direction things have gone. Yeah.
Okay. But after Sato's ordination, he could theoretically be, is it called Tanto? That the head person?
He could be trained and appointed to serve in that position. You know, all of the offices, all of the jobs in a temple are not permanent. They're temporary.
Right. Okay.
So it would be natural for us to have them rotate amongst people. But as Jamie was saying, to have somebody as Tanto or even Tenzo sometimes, it would be unusual if it's not a priest to have that situation, but that's changing. That's changing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bobby, can I interrupt for one second?
Of course. Yes, please. This is your talk.
I think Michael was Tanto with the Blue Rockazoo.
Was he? Okay.
Back before Mel convinced him to ordain.
And
the other thing I wanted to say is there has to be paths available for people that are lay teachers, and there has to be paths available for priests in temples. And there has to be paths available for priests or lay people in a monastic setting like Tassajara. And I think there also has to be paths for either lay people or priests to be, to have a hermit-like practice. So we need to find ways as a sangha, as a, the bigger sangha than any organized sangha. We need to find ways to support all four of those types of people.
I think Yosan, you have a question?
Yosan.
Yes, thank you for your time. And I remember you mentioned that Michael Wagner was pushing you or pushing his students in, you know, different ways. Could you elaborate? Could you give like some concrete examples of how that looks like?
I don't know if I can give you concrete examples, but in private, Michael would always, he's different with different people. I remember lining up for Dokusan with Michael for practice instruction, and I would listen to the student right in front of me, Marsha Angus, and they would go in there and they would laugh, and it would just be, they'd laugh for 15 minutes, and then she would come out, and then Michael would summon me, and I would go in, and he would ask me very serious questions that I couldn't possibly answer at the time. I remember one of the greatest helps to me that I spent so much time with questions that Michael asked me was, where are the edges? Where are the edges of your practice? Where are the edges of reality? Where are the edges of this now? Where are the edges of time? That was a very helpful question for me. That pushed me.
Alvino, would you like to say hello or pose a question?
Yeah, just thank you very much. I think it was a very nice discussion, especially the part about the priest who started teaching at the age of 80 and went on till 120. So I feel that all is not lost. A lot of us are so busy and still trying to find time for practice and, you know, maybe learning through the experience of teaching. So I think really appreciate all the discussion today.
Dai, would you like to say hello? What's the question?
So thank you, Jamie. So I have spent a decent amount of time at a monastery and done my share of sessions and found really rich, meaningful experiences. And I guess in the back of my head, I think, you know, if I could just get more of that, that's the direct path to waking up. And lay practice is, I guess subconsciously, I probably think of it as a hindrance to waking up, right? And so I'm wondering if you could speak to how that's not the case, how the richness of lay practice can actually inform a direct path of waking up versus, you know, hiding yourself out at a monastery, so to speak.
In reading the Vimalakirti Sutra, it gives a backstory for Vimalakirti that he's hung out in the marketplace and brothels and in gambling houses, and he's still come to these marvelous conclusions about emptiness and time and all of the conclusions that you would expect early Mahayana teachers to come to. But it doesn't, that story leaves a lot in the backstory. It doesn't tell you the whole thing. But in his practice, he had to have come to those conclusions in the midst of chaos. And that's why I pushed myself very early to sit Zazen in airports, at soccer fields, in conference rooms, of the corporate world, that you can find the absolute, the objective everywhere, and you can't be tossed around on the sea of the subjective all the time. You just got to go out and seek it instead of just letting yourself be abused and used. So just be willing to practice. Don't be worried about what people will think or what people will say. Be willing to go sit zazen in the most ridiculous place you can think of. I've sat with the homeless. I've sat on the street. I've sit anywhere and just let yourself be just the breath and see what happens.
Thank you.
Sivet, would you like to say hello?
Hello.
Hello.
So thank you, Jimmy, for your talk. Really, but I don't have any really question or maybe too many questions at the same time, but thank you for your talk. It was inspiring to me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for inspiring me.
Any closing words for us, Jamie, before we conclude?
You know, don't get too hung up in the color or the type of rakasu that people have. Your practice is much more than whether you have a rakasu. And just take your practice into your family, into your workplace, into the world, and do your best to help others. That's all.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jamie.
You're welcome. And Inru will share my email address if anybody has a question that they don't want to. There's a white dog trying to get in.
Yes, I will. I will make sure everybody has your email address, and you will send us the dissertation on lay.
I'll send you the thesis, and you can distribute it as you wish.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. Thank you all for having me. Appreciate it. See you soon, Beth.
Thank you. Thank you, Yuru, for connecting San Francisco with DC. I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Laurie, is this like your dog?
Here she is.
Bye.
Bye.